Good evening, everyone. This is Terry Lynn Coop on the Blue Plate Special, and tonight on the menu is Shane Yerke. He is best-selling novelist, author of Torn Apart and The Fury. Torn Apart, which was shortlisted for the prestigious Thriller Award and named a Book of the Year by Suspense Magazine. Shane spent 25 years as a newspaper editor, most prominently at the Chicago Sun-Times, before jumping into fiction. He now hangs his hat in the Chicago suburb of Naperville. And Fury has been called the tension and turmoil add up to high-stakes suspense as the characters are skillfully played across a global chessboard. Written like a born bard of old, you will not be disappointed. How you doing tonight, Shane?
I'm doing great. I was out hunting wildebeests, in preparation for the show tonight, but they ran away. They ran away, so I decided to come in and eat blueberry pie and some Blue Plate Special, and figured to give you a call and see what was up.
Doing your Hemingway impersonation, I see.
Just trying my best in the suburbs here. Since there are no wildebeests or anything remotely wild, we have to sort of entertain ourselves with fantasies, which is, of course, why I'm a writer.
It's hard to be a manly man in Naperville.
I'm going to give you that. Yes. It's easier to be a metrosexual than a manly man, but I do my best. I'll go several days without shaving, as my protest against unmanliness.
What is your yuppie concentration per square foot there?
It's actually not as high as you would think. It's not so much yuppies, but young families. Naperville is an upper middle class to lower upper class city, about 150,000. Great place to live, almost completely violent, crime-free, very safe, great schools, etc. But as a result, it's got a certain demographic, which is upper middle class white, younger families. So that's it's very much family oriented. And since I don't have kids, I'm sort of not outcast. That's not it at all. I've got great neighbors, but I don't fit into a lot of the things that other people do in the city, and that the city, the kind of things the city provides for entertainment tends to be more family oriented.
No, I
know
Naperville is lovely. I used to live out in Schaumburg.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
I really do love Naperville. It's just not, if you're looking for thrills and chills, it's not the place to be. But at this stage, if I want thrills and chills, I can go other places for that. But it's nice to live in a place where I can just relax and not worry about, my house being burglarized or, taxes going insane or, or gangbangers driving up and down the street shooting innocent people, like happens just, 3 miles to my east.
Well, so you're a Chicago native?
Yeah, Chicago area. I never lived in the city, but I worked in the city for a long time when I worked at the Chicago Sun-Times. But I was born and raised in a farm town 40 miles south of Chicago named Frankfort. After the town in Germany, Frankfurt, F-U-R-T, and then after World War I started, they changed the name to Fort, F-O-R-T, to remove any association with the Kaiser, and that helped when Hitler came to power later on. But it was founded by German farmers and brewers, etc. Back in the early 1800s, as so much of this part of the upper Midwest was farmers and brewers. That was pretty much it. So you had your grain growers and then you had your grain distillers.
And then plastic makers, because I used to work out at Frankfort at the mobile plant.
Yeah, you have that plant was probably one of the biggest employers, certainly the biggest private employer in Frankfurt when I was growing up, or a little later on. I don't think it was there when I was born. It came a little later, but I remember it quite distinctly from when I was still living in Frankfurt. I think when I was very young, there was a plant that made matchsticks, and that was the big deal plant. And then matchsticks went overseas to be made in China, and it got replaced by BorgWarner gaskets, making gaskets for cars. And then that went overseas, and I don't know whatever became of the building. Then mobile foam came in, and that was the new business. It's like Frankfurt could only have one big industry at a time. They couldn't have two.
Well, considering, but you said you were with the Chicago Sun-Times. When was that? Tell me about that.
That was back in my newspaper days. I started my writing career as a journalist, mostly as an editor, occasionally as a writer. But I started in high school as a sports reporter for the local weekly paper. I was a high school senior and editor of the high school paper, and I'd always wanted to be a newspaper writer, newspaper reporter, editor since second grade, when our second grade teacher introduced the concept of newspapers to us, and I saw bylines on the tops of the stories from the kids who wrote the stories. I just got so excited at the concept that I could talk to people, write a story, and see my name, in print. I thought, this is what I want to do the rest of my life, and that's a true story. And that's what I decided when I was 8. I was going to be a newspaper writer, and that's what I became. So in high school, I got a gig covering the local high school, all the sports teams for the local weekly paper, for the princely sum of $30 a month, which I thought was more money than I would ever need in my whole life. But then I wised up as I got older. Of course, gas was 10 cents a gallon too. So $30 a month. I could get to the games, with my $30, and my parents were proud because I had a paying job, and I was proud because I had, three or four stories and bylines every week in the local paper, because, I mean, I was literally the sports editor, sports writer. The editor of the paper did all the editing and all the paste-up and photography and all of that. He had one reporter to cover all the news for the three main small towns in the area. Like I say, it was a series of farm service towns along Lincoln Highway, south of Chicago, and we covered all three of those little cities. By cities, I mean 2,000 or 3,000 people,
mm-hmm.
and then all the smaller communities.
So when did you move up to the big time?
I moved to the big time. I went to college at Northern Illinois in DeKalb, worked at the newspaper there, and then got my first job in Moline, at the Moline Dispatch. Then I moved to the Joliet Herald News, and that's pretty typical for newspaper people. We're itinerant farmers. We just keep moving. To move up, you generally, if you want to move to the big leagues, you've got to work your way up through different newspapers. And that's what I did. So 5 years after I graduated college, I got a call from a guy who ran the copy desk at the Chicago Sun-Times and said, I've always kept your resume on file, and here's why. I was stuck working in Galesburg for many years right after school, before I was able to get to the big city. And I always vowed, if I ever find anybody with any kind of good resume that is working in Western Illinois and wants to come to the big city, I'm going to give them a tryout. And if they stink at it, well, so be it. But if they're good, then I'm going to give them a job, because I understand how grueling it is one, you know, being a big city newspaper man at heart, but you're, by circumstance, you're stuck in a small town out in the middle of nowhere, you know, trying to do journalism. And I never felt stuck because the Quad Cities were, it's like 300,000 people, and I grew up in a town of, well, Frankfort was 2,000, but I lived 2 miles outside of it in an unincorporated subdivision of 300. So for me, that was like moving to Chicago. But for him, it was like, oh my God, you live in Hickstown. And I didn't feel that way. I love the job, but he called and said, come in and do a tryout. So I came in, did the tryout. What's that?
What were some of your favorite stories that you did for the Sun-Times?
Sun-Times, I was mostly an editor. I didn't write much. Occasional feature story. My favorite story that I ever wrote, two favorite stories I wrote were, one actually appeared in the Sun-Times when I was in college. There was a guy who lived in DeKalb, who ran for president of the United States in the Naked Party. And he was a nudist. And he walked around DeKalb completely nude. It was the hippie, you know, kind of the post-hippie movement era. It was a college town. He was an older guy. Everyone was like, oh, yeah, there he goes, the nudie guy. You know, the cops left him alone. Everyone thought he was harmless. And he was. He was just a nudist. And he decided to run for president. So he got enough signatures to get on the ballot in Illinois. Name's Eddie Collins. So I sat and interviewed him. And that was a very strange interview, interviewing an old naked guy. And so I wrote it as a magazine piece, submitted it to Midwest Magazine, which was the magazine published by the Sun-Times at that point. It's long defunct. And the editor bought it for like $100 or something. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm rich again. So, I have a magazine clip, you know, before I even graduated college.
Hey.
So it was pretty cool.
And hey, these days, I'd vote for old naked guy in a heartbeat. So.
Oh, I liked old Eddie. I was he actually had a lot of sensible ideas, and it mostly was like, you know, along the lines of everybody just be cool. You know, get naked. You can't fight when you're naked. You know, things hurt. And it just,
get naked,
it just,
get
yeah,
stoned,
that,
be cool.
Yeah, in that weird old hippie way, it made a great deal of sense. So I kind of wrote it that way, and the editor liked it. You know, as a kind of a nostalgia, you know, hippie nostalgia, running for president kind of piece. So we bought it, ran it in the magazine, and I was just tickled pink. And that plus my college and high school clips got me my first job in Moline as an editor. I had a choice between being the bureau chief of a county in the middle of nowhere, one-person bureau, me, or be an editor at the main city desk, you know, at headquarters. So I chose the editor route because I wanted to be around people. I didn't want to be stuck out, you know, 30 miles from nowhere. And that's kind of the route I went.
Being the bureau chief and the bureau of one.
Yeah, that's, at least he got the title, which was kind of cool. You know, but the Jerry, the editor, put it that way. He says, I'm going to give you a choice. I think you're really good. I'm going to give you a choice. I got two jobs open. You get first choice. He said, you can be the bureau chief of Whiteside County. You run the Prophetstown Bureau. And I'm thinking, wow, I'm going to run a bureau. How many people under my command? And I said, and I thought, wait a minute, Whiteside County, that's about as big as Lincoln Estates where I grew up. It's just a big county, but not many people, more cows than people. I said, how many people are in this bureau? He said, you. I said, oh, okay, what's the other job? He said, assistant editor on the desk here, you know, putting the paper out every day. I said, I think I'll take that job. He said,
I don't blame you.
No,
so when did
no,
you
I wanted
start,
to be where
when did your when did your thoughts start turning towards fiction?
I had always wanted to write fiction, particularly crime stories, because I grew up reading the Hardy Boys and then graduating to Mickey Spillane and then graduating into the classical, you know, Maltese Falcon and all, you know, the Dashiell Hammett stuff. The guy who lived on the boat in Florida, I can't remember his name, Travis McGee.
Mm-hmm.
All those, you know, classic Private Eye and Tough Guy, Hard-Boiled, you know, crime writing in general. I really enjoyed it. My dad was a cop, small-town cop. I liked the action, but I didn't want to be a cop. Because I really didn't like, you know, I didn't like telling people what to do. And as a cop, it's pretty much the job description, you know, is even if you're nice about it, ultimately you're pushing people around, you know, because you have to. And I really didn't want to do that, but I liked the action. So I figured next best thing would be newspaper reporter, because you're always in the middle of some kind of action. But I always thought that in the back of my mind, maybe someday I'll write a crime story, I'll write a thriller. I always wanted to do that. So I'd worked in newspapers for 25 years. I started at the Sun-Times in 82, and I left in the late 90s. And my wife, my late wife, Gerald, said to me, she said, "Yeah, you're coming up on, I think at the time I was like my late 40s, and I've been in the news business 25 years since I started really early." She says, "What do you want to do with the, you know, second half of your, you know, the second act of your career?" I said, "Well, what do you mean?" She said, "Do you want to keep writing, you know, do you want to stay in journalism, or do you want to try, you know, writing thrillers like you've been talking about?" And I said, "Well, I'd like to do the thrillers, but, you know, with the steady income, insurance." She said, "No, it's not what I asked." I said, "What do you want to do?" And they said, "Well, I'd like to write thrillers, but, you know, it's going to cut the family income in half." And she's like, "Idiot, listen to me. What do you want to do if money is not a consideration?" And this is how we talked. You know, I said, "Mm-hmm. I want to leave the paper because I'm writing, I'm editing the same stories over and over. It's just different people, different names, different circumstance. Bank buys bank, five die in house fire, you know, whatever. You know, there's only so many news situations. Even Houston going on right now is a catastrophe. It's just a bigger catastrophe, but it's the same catastrophe as you see every, you know, couple of years in the States and you see every year somewhere on the planet. So after you've done journalism for so many years, you start covering the same events again. And as an editor, you start making the same assignments, you start writing the same headlines. And it just gets a little tedious when you pretty much know, you know, there's going to be an air crash, or there's going to be a good news story out there. It's going to be, you know, this, that, or the other. You know, the stock market is going to collapse, so you got to assign these six reporters to do this, that, and the other. So I was getting just a little bit bored. So I figured, you know, I told her, "I'd really like to write crime novels." She said, "Then do it." I said, "We can't afford to do it." She said, "Let's figure out how to make it work." She says, I know for a while you've wanted to do it. We've talked about it. And frankly, I think that if you have a chance to do something you really want to do, or two things in your life you really want to do, because I know you love journalism, but I also know you love the idea of this, then let's see if we can make it work. And if it doesn't work or you don't like it, you can always get a job back at newspapers. They'll always be around.
Yes.
little did we know at the time, that was, about a year later is when the internet really started booming and newspapers started dying. So there went Plan B. But that's
so
how
which
I,
was your first,
that's how it,
which
that's
was
how
your
I
first
started
novel?
Doing it. I
which was your first novel?
That, my first novel, actually, my first two novels never got published. They were religious thrillers that really mirrored what happened in the United States, 9/11, religious terrorism in the United States. But it was written before September 11th, so I never got any traction selling them. I went to a bunch of agents and agents and publishers, and they all said, "We love your writing style, but this plot is preposterous. Flying airplanes into towers, killing the president, nobody will believe it because of the United States, and we have freedom of religion, and something like that could never happen here." I'm like, okay. But if you ever write something besides this, let us know. So, of course, being an idiot, I wrote a sequel. And,
well,
of course that went over like a lead balloon. Then 9/11 happened, and so, religious terrorism fiction was dead for at least a decade. I talked to an agent that I got kind of friendly with when I was making the rounds the first time, and he said, "Don't even go there with this story in New York. You're gonna create a lot of hatred in the community because we in New York think of this as our tragedy, not yours. That this didn't happen to America, it happened to New York. And if you propose a story about, fanatics blowing up, stuff in the United States, we're going to take that very personally and put you on a blacklist." He said, "Not me. I'm not from New York. I don't have that emotional tie." He said, "But a lot of the people in the book business are, and all you're going to do is anger them." So he said, "I would try." He said, "I really like your writing style. I would try writing something else and just put this on the back burner." And so
which novel is the first one that sold?
So the first one that sold was Blown Away, and that mm-hmm. came because of this guy's advice. I just decided I'm just going to write me a little cop thriller. It's just going to be a one book thing, just to do it. I'm going to sell it, make a few dollars. It won't, it's not going to go anywhere, but just to prove to myself I can do it, and then I'll figure out what else, I want to do after that. And so I wrote it, and my agent sold it, and the editor who bought it said, "I really like this. What else do you have in the series?" And my agent said to me, "What other books do we have in the series?" And I said, "What series?" He said, "Oh, the one they want to pay you a lot of money to write." I said, "Oh, that series. Okay. give me a couple days to create a series." So I came up with a bunch of ideas, and bless her heart, the editor liked two of them that I came up with. So I wound up with a trilogy, but Blown Away was the first of the three.
So is this the series that's set in Naperville?
Yes. It's a traditional cops versus serial killers. Police procedural.
Recurring character?
Yes. Female protagonist, female rookie cop. But I made her middle age is not 40 anymore. Middle age is more, more 50. But back when I wrote it, 40 struck me as more middle-agey. I wanted a woman that had lived a life and then became a cop. She wasn't a 21-year-old rookie straight out of the academy and didn't know anything about anything. So I created her, and for some reason it just really appealed to an audience and became a it just became a national bestseller. And I got the news about that on my 50th birthday, which I thought was pretty cool.
Hey, there's nothing wrong with that. So you're saying there's three books in the Emily series.
Yes, Emily Thompson is her name, and she starts in Blown Away. It's a countdown action suspense cop thriller, where she has, believe it's 72 hours. I start 72 hours before her 40th birthday. And a serial killer comes to town and is killing people and leaving their bodies in the shapes of old baby boomer board games like Monopoly, Duck Duck Goose, a Time Bomb, etc. And she has to figure out why he's doing this. And it's clear that it's aimed at her personally because of the clues he leaves. But she has no idea why.
So what comes after Blown Away?
That is followed by Cut to the Bone, which is which is my treatise on capital punishment, particularly the electric chair in Illinois. Because that's a debate that's been ongoing here since we've had our share of serial killers. And Illinois is also the state with the distinction of having the most people on death row let out of prison because of actual innocence proved through DNA testing and other means. So, in other words, we convicted the wrong guy again and again and again and again. And it got so bad that the governor at the time, George Ryden, just shut down capital punishment and commuted everybody on death row to life in prison on the theory that if we've screwed up this much that we can find evidence for how many of these people are actually innocent, but we don't have the physical evidence to prove it. So Ryan just says, I'm not taking that chance. So that's what Cut to the Bone is about, is exploring that whole topic, which I found really interesting.
And then what comes next?
Comes Torn Apart. And that was a finalist for the ICW Thriller Award. And that's where I finally hit my writing stride. I thought, I liked Blown Away and Cut to the Bone, but I was really struggling with learning how to write long form. When you're trained as a newspaper reporter, you're told over and over again, get rid of every word that isn't crucial to the story. So in the newspaper world, for people who don't know, 500 words is a long story. That's just in the novel, that's like the opening sequence. So So imagine, going from a life of writing 500 to 1,000 word stories for a living to all of a sudden, it's an open canvas, 70,000, 80,000, 100,000, 120,000 words. It's whatever you need to tell the story. Novels are getting a little shorter than they used to be. Publishers like them more in the 80 to 90,000 range. But that's still, light years more than I was used to. So on my first draft of my first book, I wrote like 25,000 words and it told the whole story. So I looked at it and I said, I guess I need to go back and add place and color and smells and all of the stuff that you leave out of newspaper stories. So it was a learning curve, but it was fun because it just opened me up to, I can actually write about the world. This is the stuff I always wanted to put in newspaper stories and never could because space requirements. And
right.
Now I've got this there are no, and that's just for print books. You know, for the internet, you know, the sky is literally the limit. You can write as many damn words as you want to.
And I'll tell anyone who's listening that Torn Apart is on sale on ebook for 99 cents. So you need to go grab it right now before somebody realizes what they've done.
Yes, I like that. I like 99 cents. I'm going to go out and buy my own book for 99 cents, and store it up on my reader. So I have cases of print books, but I never did download my ebooks because I've read them already. Like all writers, we read our works 800 times before we send them off to the publisher.
Definitely.
But for 99 cents,
you need to do it.
99 cents, I'm going to go out and spend that buck. I encourage anyone listening to go spend that buck tonight.
Hey, I did.
Bless your heart. I appreciate it.
So you've done this trilogy of cop books that are very, very procedural. They're tied to a suburban location. Now suddenly you dip your toe into the world of the big thriller.
Yes, and deliberately. The problem with the trilogy was people like William Kent Kruger deliberately chose to set his magnificent books in a small area, in a small part of the country, and keep the stories very tightly compacted in that area. I never intended for that to happen. I always thought that Blown Away was just going to be a one-book deal. And it turned out Kensington would have let it go on as long as I wanted to keep writing the book. The problem for me was that, like most publishers, thrillers are a genre, and the publisher tends to want it to fit in a formula that works for them, which means sales. So if your first book is a bestseller because it's a serial killer and the lead character is a female cop and she's in personal peril and she's in Naperville, well, then the second book needs to be the same and the third book needs to be the same and on and on and on. So after the third book, I was completely out of ideas as to how many serial killers can you bring to a white upper middle class suburb of Chicago, put the officer in personal peril. It's not just a case for her to solve. She actually has to be part of the crime. You know, the guy is coming after her. This time it's personal. You know, every movie cliche you want to think of. That's the kind of expectation they had for my books. And I couldn't think of any way to really top what I had done or do anything different from what I had done in the first three. So I proposed The Fury, which was a 180-degree change. This was my big thriller, big global thriller. It's based in Chicago and Mexico with flashbacks to the Cold War, and it starts with the recreation of the Deepwater Horizon explosion, which is kind of a prescient for our talk tonight with the Houston disaster going on.
Yes.
And that dislodges some doomsday weapons from the Cold War that were secretly buried in the Gulf, and the doomsday weapons wash up in New Mexico, get into the hands of a cartel, crazy cartel kingpin, who decides to use them against the United States. And so there's one person in the United States, a cop in Chicago who is in close enough position to possibly be able to stop him before he kills a few million people with these doomsday weapons. It's a huge story. It took me a long time to do all the research, but all the flashback chapters were all set in historic. They're historically accurate. They're made up, but they're based on real events, and they show the building of the doomsday weapons that are front and center in the book.
Excellent.
And so I just show the progression of the how the weapons were invented in in pre-Nazi Germany, and then the Nazis taking them over, and then Great Britain invents a better version of it, and then the United States buys the recipe and creates a super version of it, and then everyone decides now that we have thermonuclear weapons, we don't need these old doomsday weapons anymore. So we're just going to dump them in the oceans right off our continental shelf. Well, all that stuff is true, and all the stuff is still sitting there, rusting,
leaking. What could go wrong?
Leaking. Yeah, what could go wrong is correct. Once in a while, a little bomblet of the stuff washes up on shore. Some poor schmuck walks by and kicks it, thinking it's an old can or something, and it blows up and kills them. So the stuff is still active, 60 years later. And in large mass quantities, it can kill millions of people. So that's what the book is based on.
To segue, Fury came out in 2015, correct? As a matter of fact, we're coming up on the two-year anniversary of the release.
Yes.
But there's a reason why you haven't put out a book since then, isn't there?
I'm afraid so. I got vapor locked emotionally. My wife died. My wife is was a breast cancer survivor from 14 years ago. Her name is Jerrel, Jerrele, and we were married for nearly 40 years. We'd met each other in college. Well, she was diagnosed with stage 2, low 2 breast cancer in one breast, and a few of the cells had escaped into the lymph node system, but only into the first packet. Women understand this stuff, men might not, but basically it escaped the cancer. A little bit of the cancer escaped from the locality of the breast and got into the lymph node system, which potentially can let it circulate throughout the body, which is a bad thing. So they did a lumpectomy, and then they dosed her with high radiation, and then 6 weeks of chemotherapy, and all the all the stuff that entails: losing your hair, getting sick, getting thrush, which is a fungal disease in your mouth and your throat, to where you can't eat or swallow or drink without massive amounts of pain. And it's caused because the chemo drugs are destroying your anti-infection system. It's just knocking it out completely.
But she pulled through the first time. Yes.
She pulled through the first time. We went through 5 years of anxiety. That's the first hurdle. When you're clear after 5 years, you start to breathe a little easier. And then when you hit 10 years, medical community says you're cured, as much as, anybody could be cured of anything. And so then we finally just started looking at the future. And she had 5 more years to work before she wanted to retire. And then we would start traveling again. We did a lot of traveling when we were young, and then put everything kind of on hold because I switched careers, and she was busy with her career as a technical writer, and project manager at Bell Laboratories. And everything was just going along ducky. And then she started having trouble swallowing 3 years ago. Went to a doctor. They thought it was a gallbladder, so they took that out. Then they thought it was GERD, so they gave her medicine for that. Found out that wasn't working, so they did a CAT scan and found that her breast cancer cells, not all of them were killed in the chemo assault, and a few cells remained in her system and came back 13 years later. So she now had stage 4 metastatic breast cancer, and you do not survive metastatic breast cancer. It's only it's a matter of managing the time you have left. You can't cure it. So so she worked for about, because she's really stubborn, unlike myself, who's just a pussy cat. She's very stubborn, and I love her dearly for it. She went to work every day with her cancer cap on, and she just had that way of just, you know, people would look at her, and she'd like, I got cancer, and I'm dying. What can I tell you? And they were like, oh, okay, tell me about it. And she told them about it, and, you know, it was just one of those things.
So when did you lose her?
Lost her 2 years ago tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. So she started dying, taking her last breaths as we're talking now, actually. So she fell asleep. She really fell asleep for the final time starting about right now 2 years ago. And just slept through the night and then took her last breath 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. So she died August 31st. We buried her September 3rd, which was her birthday. And then September 4th, I had my book launch for The Fury. It was the most bizarre week of my entire life, going from death.
We remember those dates and times, don't we?
Seared into our brain. I mean,
definitely.
And what are the odds? What are the odds of all that happening? So, she was sick for a year, then came home for 3 weeks from the hospital. After the oncologist said, nothing more we can do.
Well,
and so she says, I'm going to die at home then, surrounded by my loved ones, and I don't want to be hooked up to machines.
So you didn't really write for 2 years?
No, I completely abandoned any pretense at writing. Other than Facebook snippets, that's the only link I shared a lot of the story of her getting sick and dying with friends on Facebook, and it really had a very powerful resonance with people. They liked the fact that I could talk about it openly. Women in particular appreciated that somebody was telling their story, and it was being told in an emotional way by a guy, but in a meaningful way as well. Yeah,
It's
all about me. Well, it wasn't. It was all about us, and that's how I wrote these pieces. And it just really struck a chord with people, and I just kind of kept them up on my adventures. Over the next couple of years, I had a whole series of medical calamities myself, falling downstairs, getting my own gallbladder attack 2 months after she died. I'm like, this is very ominous. But finally getting to go to a thriller conference again, and then falling off a stair and tearing the Achilles tendon off my left heel. So I had major surgery.
I met you at a thriller conference where you managed to go an entire day without hurting yourself.
I know. It was insane. Was it Milwaukee?
That was in Milwaukee. But I want to go because
I'm
keeping an eye on the clock here. You've used parts of her story in a different way now, haven't you? Because I happen to know for a fact that you're writing again.
Yes. I am proud to announce that you and I and 18 other people are part of an anthology that's being published October 1st called Betrayed. And it's a collection of short stories about people who survive crimes, particularly domestic abuse crimes. And the proceeds are all being donated, all the profits and anything that the authors would have been paid to write the stories, we're all donating all those funds to an organization that stages interventions and intervenes in domestic violence cases because they're violence against people, crimes, they're crime victims. And this organization tries to get those people out of those situations before it becomes murder. And I think as a crime writer, that is just so up my alley that Pam Stack, who runs the Authors on the Air radio network, which is the network.
Which is where we're talking right now.
That's where we're talking right now. That Blue Plate is a part of this network. Pam Stack called me personally and said, "Shane, I know you're grieving. I know you're not writing, but I really, really need you for this project. I need your skills. I know how good a writer you are, and I really want you in this book. If you can just please set aside your grief or use your grief in a way that will help other people," and then she described what the book was about. And I said, if it was any other, this plain old, shoot 'em up, private eye thing, I would say no, but this is such a unique and wonderful book that's coming out, and the people, the audience, not the reading audience, but the audience that we're trying to help with these stories is so cool. What else could I do?
How was it to go to short form?
Actually, it was fun. I've never written a short story. Well, actually, I did. I've written a lot of short stories. They were just newspaper stories, but I've never written short fiction before. And actually, it was a lot of fun because novels take forever to write, especially when I still have a news person's mentality of, if it takes more than a couple of days, it's like, oh, crap, let's get going. Let's get this thing over with. Real novelists, I am a real novelist. I have 4 books published. But, real novelists, revel in, I get to sit down 8 hours a day and just write and write and write and write. And tomorrow I get to do it again. And they could do it for years on a book if they had the time to do that and just revel and luxuriate in it. I get very impatient. Fortunately, I tend to write quickly. That's the news training in me. But then I revise a lot, too. So it takes me a while to write a novel. The short story just kind of wrote itself because I could see the end of the tunnel, and it wasn't the train, and it was like right across the street. It wasn't 18 miles down the road, like with a novel. So I really, really enjoyed the process of a short story. So I'm thinking of putting together my own anthology of my own short stories at some point. Because I have half a dozen. have a half dozen good ideas that I'd like to do. But Pam inspired me to get off my behind and try writing again, and I found how much fun I had forgotten how much fun it was. And
Do you think your voice is different now than it was, say, when you were writing The Fury?
Yeah, I think my voice now is going to be a little more simple and a little more direct. My books until this point are very complicated plots. There's a lot of people, there's a lot of moving characters, there's a lot of places, even if the ones that are set in Naperville, it was an ensemble because it was a police department. So there were a lot of people doing a lot of different things, and I had to make sure they all worked together. This short story is not a new voice for me, but it's a more simplistic approach. I wrote it in first person to ensure that I kept the focus narrow instead of dragging a whole bunch of sub-characters into it. And I think that really strengthened the emotional impact of the story. So I think that's the direction. I mean, I think that Gerald's death and my being away from the frenzy of knocking out novels for a couple of years has given me a little bit of different perspective on my writing and my voice. So I think this is going to be a good direction for me.
Well, since I've read your story for the anthology, I can say that this is going to be one that nobody's going to want to miss.
You're
returning in a very, very big way.
I really appreciate that. I'm a big fan of your writing, and if you're saying that, that means a whole lot to me.
I think it's the anthology across the board, and I'm going to steal 30 seconds of your time here because I've got a neat little announcement too. The anthology that I'm in, which is called Just to Watch Them Die, which is music based stories based on the music of Johnny Cash.
Oh, cool! I love the Man in Black.
Should be coming out tomorrow.
Tomorrow? Oh my God!
It should be coming out tomorrow. If not, it'll be this week for sure.
This is the sneaky announcement you were hinting at before.
Yes, that's my sneaky announcement, and what everyone did is they chose a song, and they took that song and interpreted it, and I chose the song "Man in Black."
Oh, okay.
And turned it into crime fiction because that's what I do.
Right.
So that should be coming out tomorrow. I'll be plastering the world with the links, and it's another one I've had the chance to read the galleys. It's just simply amazing. For example, Gardner's story is not to be missed. Absolutely, positively not to be missed.
What was his song?
I don't have the table of contents in front of me, so I can't tell you, but it's amazing. And it's an incredible collection of crime fiction by some amazing, amazing writers. So, yes, you need to be writing more.
Okay, I can do that. Who's putting out your anthology?
It's coming out from Gutter Books.
Gutter Books, okay.
And out of the gutter is an online flash fiction, which is limited to 1,500 words.
Yes.
And
yeah.
I've been lucky enough to have a story in Out of the Gutter, which I consider to be a great accomplishment. And I highly recommend that too, as for your daily. And if you think writing for this anthology at 5,000 to 7,000 words was a challenge, well, sir, I double dog dare you to write at 1,500 words.
May not be as hard as they think, because again, my mindset is very tight and narrow anyway. You know, that's just bread in my bones. But I've never done that. I've never done that for fiction. That'll be the key challenge.
I completely challenge you. Shotgun Honey is 700 words, and Gutter is either 1,000 or 1,500. So I challenge you to write something for one of the two of those. And that is raw meat crime fiction.
Oh, yeah. Shotgun Honey. Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that name.
Definitely. Well, I've got to wrap this up tonight. I could sit here and talk to you all night. And I hope to run into you again at a conference soon.
And
actually, Shotgun Honey is a perfect place to end, because Shotgun Honey is an imprint of Down and Out Books, who are the sponsor of this show. They've been celebrating 6 years of award-winning crime fiction and have racked up 8 Anthony Award nominations for the BCON coming up in Toronto. You can check them out at www.downandoutbooks.com. And one thing of interest to you is they are really celebrating the return of the pulp crime novella.
That's nice. It's long overdue.
You should check out their catalog for sure. It's www.downandoutbooks.com. And then my last little bit of
They are
amazing. And I'm proud to have them sponsoring this show. And then my little housekeeping announcement is, this broadcast is owned and copyrighted by Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. And you can follow the Blue Plate Special on Facebook to stay up to date with which author is next up on the menu. On Friday, we're changing things up again, and I'll be talking to Foyna Jamerson, who has written a comedic vampire novel called Mostly Dead Melvin. We're going to be starting heading on that glide path into Halloween. Shane, I want to thank you for coming on tonight, and I will definitely be talking to you.
Oh, this has been such a delight, Terry. And if anybody wants to find out anything about me, it's the website is shaneyerke.com, shaneyerike.com.
Check it out. It's a great website. And I will say goodnight. Thank you very much.
And good night to you, and thanks for having me on the board.